You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
You want answers?
We're caught in a trap. I can't walk out because I love you too much, baby.
Here's another email. Cabela's is holy ground. Be careful how you talk about it, boy. Trust me, I know.
When you don't believe a word I'm saying,
Elvis, the man.
We can't go on together.
In Vegas, with his cape on, sweating his ass off. In the middle of the 60s, no less. All of his friends saying, dude's a mess. You think any of them said, dude, we need to get you to a detox. We need to PT. We need to slim you down. You're fat. You're disgusting. Okay? We gotta get you rocked up, man. It's for your own good. All these drugs you're taking? Come on, man. That's the problem with the bobblehead, hanging out with the bobblehead crew. You can see where it's got us relative to American foreign policy. Bobblehead generals and admirals.
Yeah, let's expand the war in Afghanistan. We'll make that place safe. Yep.
Good idea, Mr. Rumsfeld. We'll just knock it over, and we'll fly in some expats from the United States. We'll hand the government to them, and then we'll just, like, unass it. We'll get the hell out of there. That'll work. No problem. Hey, what about the war plan says that if we do this, all this other crazy shit? Oh, come on. Those war plans are written by idiots. We don't need to follow that. Just listen to me, Donnie Rumsfeld. Come on. Nod your head.
Okay.
Bobbleheads, man. Surround yourself with bobbleheads and you get what you get. Because I hate you too much, baby. Caught in a trap with Priscilla Presley. That's an above average trap, let me tell you. I've been in some traps in my life. That's an above average trap. This just proves how crazy that dude was. All right. Roger Turner. Recently, this is where I was. I was introducing this segment when Doofus called up. So the let's see. I met Roger Turner. He's a second lieutenant. I'm a captain teaching at the infantry officer course. I'd just gone over there. I'd kind of what's called snapped in with his class, right? So I'd gone through the course with his class and getting ready to teach. And so got to know him and his classmates pretty well. And you could tell back then he's a good lieutenant. I mean, physically fit, good sense of humor, smart, you know, asked smart guy questions. And, so then, you know, we cross paths again. He's a major. I'm a major in 2004. He comes to do current ops. And then I wind up working for him in current ops. So, I worked with three of my lieutenants, in current ops. JJ Carroll, who's a great guy. John Myrna, another great guy, played football at Florida State with Deion Sanders. Yeah, he tells me in the midst of my Deion Sanders hating, you'd love him. If he was your teammate, you'd love him. I said, don't even tell me that. He said, I'm just telling you the truth. He's a great guy. He's a great teammate. He does stuff that nobody even hears about for people. What? Exactly. So anyway, Myrna's funny. So we crossed paths as a major. I go back to Fallujah 2 years later. I go back to Fallujah 2 years later with 5th Marines. Roger's now a lieutenant colonel. He's a CO-37, I think. It was 37. I'm pretty sure it is. He was in Ramadi, and they're leveling Ramadi at the time. Right? Fallujah was, like, still kind of like the same as it was after we rolled through it and we secured it. Ramadi was, like, carnage still going on. Fallujah had been cooled out. I mean, there was still bad stuff that happened there. People would get in, but not like Ramadi. Ramadi was still Thunderdome in 2006. So Turner and 3-7 are up there dropping buildings, doing stuff we never did in 2004, annihilating Ramadi. And then that annihilation continues in Ramadi until, 2 years ago? ISIS gets run out of there, and now it's like rocks. Rock City in Ramadi. So anyway, next time I cross paths with Roger is in 2010. He's now the regimental commander for 5th Marine Regiment. We sit down in some ops meeting, talk about doing our turnover with 5th Marines. They're coming over on their pre-deployment site survey, blah, 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 blah. Regimental commander Roger Turner, and I laugh. I'm like, that's awesome, man. He's a great dude. So cross paths again with Roger as they took over for us in 2011. And just to give you some sense of the kind of professional that he is, he walked in one day or grabbed me at the end of a work day and he said, hey, I'm going to come hang out with you guys all day tomorrow. I need to know what you do because I've heard the legend of you guys. And I started laughing. I said, we're good. And I said, look, I've done this current op starting with him back in Ramadi. And he said, I heard about it up at division that they don't even mess with you guys because you guys are pretty much good. And I said, well, we don't look at ourselves as just this kind of link in a command. Our responsibility is to make everybody better, to pay attention so that we run the medevacs faster, to clear supporting arms quicker, to monitor what's going on when you're in contact so that when you begin to turn your head and ask for a 3/4-inch socket, we already have it on the ratchet in our hand. And as you turn your head and begin to extend your hand, we slap it in your hand. Our job is to make you better by paying attention and leaning into it. And, you know, he goes, Mac, that's awesome. He goes, that's what I want to do is I just want to replicate what you guys are doing. And he said, so I'll be around tomorrow. So he came in and he spent a couple hours with me. And I want to say that he spent at least an hour with everybody in that COC. He was there all day and into the evening, you know, and I don't mean like with the officers. I meant with the journal clerk, right, with the cop manager, with the intel rep, right, with the ops chief, right, with the fires guys, with the communicators, with the UCM, UMCC, Uniform Movement Control Center staff in COIC, who's accounting for both civilian and military convoys in the AO. So he sat down with every one of them with his notebook. He'd take a break. He'd come back. He'd sit down with the next person. And so he could get it clear in his head. How are we accounting for? How are we command and controlling? How are we leaning into? How are we able to do good things? How are we able to shave lives off medevacs on a daily basis so that we're running the fastest medevacs in Afghanistan? How are we doing that at the distances that we're doing it? What does it take? And so he's a professional's professional and a good guy. So he went back to Helmand as a brigadier general, as the head of Task Force Southwest. And the historical relationship that the Marine Corps has had in Helmand Province with the 215th Corps made it a natural that guys like Roger would go back, given his familiarity with the players there, with the people there, because it's the same sheikhs, right? It's the same village elders. It's the same people. So going back there with some knowledge of where you're going, what you're doing, getting spun up on the current situation, and then kind of seeing the way ahead. But what I really wanted you to hear is his thoughts on advising so you don't create dependency, So you're actually enabling, because that's the mission, to support, train, and advise. Okay? And so a lot of people, when they think advise, they think of supporting arms. We're going to help them win the war through our supporting arms. That and that's a piece of it, no doubt. But I think the way he talks about it like smart guys talk about it. How do you advise in this context in Afghanistan? And then the other thing I want you to pay attention to is, you know, he talks about doing it in a cost-effective way so that you can sustain it, which is no small piece of this, because the sustainment piece is important, not walking away, you know, that it will wind down as a conditions-based event, not as on some kind of artificial timeline. Okay, and again, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff just went there, and I would tell you a guy who wouldn't lie if you told him to. And what he said was, "I am trying to refrain myself from being too optimistic based on what I've seen." Okay, what did that mean? That means I've seen the ups and downs before, and I don't want to get carried away. But I'm seeing things, and this is a quote: "I'm seeing things that I've never seen here before." In terms of their planning, execution, and their ability to sustain areas that they've won. That's their planning. It's their execution. Us in a support and advise and oversight role, maybe. So, anyway, with all of that said, this is Roger Turner at Brookings Institute, interviewed by Michael O'Hanlon, which is his own heavy hitter. So you'll hear this, and then and I'll break into it as I move to do. Then after you hear Turner, we'll take a break, and you'll hear the Commandant, General Neller, talk. So program's going to go at least 2 more hours, so sit back, relax, enjoy the morning, and welcome to Wednesday Marathon here on All Marine Radio.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Brookings. Happy holiday weekend. I'm Michael Hanlon with the Foreign Policy Program. And I have the privilege of introducing Brigadier General Roger Turner, who's just back from Afghanistan, where he's been working to restore U.S. presence and restore U.S. mentorship in the Helmand province, one of the crucial provinces of the country in the battles of the last 17 years. So we're going to hear from General Turner with his initial presentation. He's got some slides, which will be nice for situational awareness and for repositioning us inside that Afghan space, understanding the geography and the military topography of Helmand Province. He'll talk through a little bit of what's been happening there over the last year. Then he and I will get together for a conversation on stage before we invite your questions, and we'll do all that in 60 minutes. Just a couple of brief words, therefore, about
all right, just a couple of brief words before O'Hanlon gets going too much. If you look on the podcast page, right, you'll see this up. It doesn't have the audio that goes with it because the audio isn't done. However, it does have the slides that they're going to talk about. So if you're following along and you're listening and you want to take a look at the slide that Turner's going to brief from, it's up there. So all you got to do is you got to click on the podcast and it opens up in another page, and the featured image is his slide. So you can go ahead and do that. You can check him out. But the audio isn't up there yet. So if you hit the audio button on that thing, it ain't going to play. With all that said, Michael O'Hanlon talking about Roger Turner.
General Turner, whom we're thrilled to have. We've been exchanging stories about all the different times he's worked for the generals Kelly, Mattis, and Allen, who continue to be prominent across town and at Brookings. And we're thrilled to have such an important Marine general, and watch out for where he may be headed, given where the pedigree has been going of late. But where he's headed in the short term is to California to help train Marines, which I know is near and dear to his heart. He has been in the Marine Corps since 1984 through the ROTC program and going to the University of Maryland, an infantry officer. He's a very young man by my standards, but he's old enough to have been through almost all the big missions of the last 20-some years, starting with Operation Desert Storm, quite active throughout the broader Pacific region, as most Marines are at one point or another in their careers in the 1990s. And then for the 10-year period of sort of Operation Iraqi Freedom through the early 2010s, he spent roughly half that time, by my calculations, in either Iraq or Afghanistan. He then came back to the United States for a while, but as I say, spent over a year in Helmand Province as a mentor and the lead American advisor to the Afghan military in Helmand Province. So without further ado, please join me in giving a big Brookings welcome to General Roger Turner.
Well, good morning, and Michael, thank you for the gracious introduction, and really just like to thank the whole Brookings team for, you know, really just being welcoming hosts to us this morning. So I would like to take a second just to introduce a couple of members of my team that are important, and you may have some questions for them. First, Nazir Ahmed here. Nazir was our cultural advisor, and he's got about 7 or 8 years in the Helmand Province, and just obviously recently returned. So if you're writing about Helmand or researching about Helmand and you're not talking to Nazir, you're missing a golden primary source, and so I would offer that. And then Captain Hill Hamrick, who was aide-de-camp but also is an intelligence officer and was key to the team between these two and our ability to interface with the Afghan leaders and kind of connect to the lead elements and the like, really greatly increased our effectiveness, and so I'm indebted to those two individuals. The rest of the team has now been disestablished and has moved back to other things. As we were relieved by another Marine task force, so Task Force Southwest, which we were part of, still exists, and they're about 60 or 70 days in, and the good part of that is they've been able to maintain or even increase some of the successes that we saw. So, and I'll make comments with that in mind, because certainly our contribution was not unique, and it's been sustained based on Brigadier General Watson, who is now the commander there. Okay, so what I hope to do today is to kind of maybe ramp down a level. There's obviously a lot of discussion about the South Asia strategy. There's been lots of discussion as late as the Secretary and the Chairman and General Nicholson have been kind of talking about kind of where we are 6 months into the South Asia strategy and, you know, and about a year into the some of the changes that have been made in Afghanistan and really kind of where we are with that. So what I'm going to try to do is bring it down a level to talk at kind of the tactical level and how tactical success in Helmand connects to operational objective for both the alliance and for the United States in particular. And so we'll we'll kind of touch on that. But there's also a lot of discussion about kind of partnered operations, and by, with, and through is kind of the popular vernacular. So, you know, by a partner, with a partner, through a partner, but part of the piece on that is nobody knows, like, hey, what's under the hood of that, right? What's the method of that? How do you do that? How do you actually create capability by, with, and through a partner? So I'll spend a little bit of time on that, because I think it's important. And now, like, strategically, as we face a possibility now of great power war, great power competition, and then we also have important regional actors that are serious threats to us. And then, but the violent extremist problem is not going away. And so how can we address violent extremists and groups that are going to take advantage of these ungoverned spaces? How do we do that in a way that's sustainable for the military and also sustainable for the economy? And then be able to tackle the violent extremist problem, but then still have the capability to go after regional actors if necessary, or compete at the strategic level if necessary. So I'll just kind of ask that as foreshadowing, and we get through it. There may be some things that you want to bring up at the question and answer period. Okay, and I will also caveat that that really my experience has only been in Helmand, say, in Afghanistan. So I served there as a colonel, as a regimental commander, 2011 and 2012, and then again just now. So I really can't speak at all about what's going on in Kandahar, what's going on in Kabul, you know, the effects of the National Unity Government, except for where it connects to Helmand and really that piece. So I can't really, you know, I can't speak of the country as a whole. So that'll be important as we kind of get into the Q&A and the like. Okay, so I think what the bottom line up front really is that we're seeing great success in Helmand over the last year. So we deployed last April, and and got into the situation there, and over the course of time, we were able to effectively enable our partner to steal the initiative from the Taliban, and really, once that initiative was taken, our Afghan partners were keen to maintain it, and they've maintained pretty incredible tempo against the enemy, and I'll show you some of the results of that. And they have, they with our help, have really put the Taliban on the back foot, which is really, really critical. So, all right, so let me kind of get into it. For those that aren't familiar, I just need to spend just a minute on orientation, so I'll do that briefly. So the area in red lined out was our area of operations. So Helmand province on the right side of that, the Nimruz province on the left. And, you know, that's about 200 or 300 miles from Kandahar, from Kabul, and about 60 or 70 miles from Kandahar. And bordered by Iran on the west, Pakistan in the south, and then kind of connecting in to the mountainous areas. The next slide really shows you the Helmand province, not the whole thing, but really the key areas. So Helmand and Nimruz are different than the rest of the country. So, you know, most people conjure mountainous and things like that when they think about Afghanistan and snow and things like that. It's not that. It's very flat. Very, very dry desert, with the exception of the green areas, which is really the prominent feature in the lifeblood of the area, is the Helmand River. So running north to south, starting up in Kajaki, coming down through Garesh, Galashkargah, down through Nawab and Gamsir, and then it hooks and it goes in, and that water ends up in Iran, which is obviously key to some of the agreements that the government of Afghanistan has with Iran on the water rights and that sort of thing. Most of you are also aware about the USAID project that greatly expanded the arable terrain in the Helmand province. It was built in the 50s and 60s. So the Kajaki Dam and then the canal project, so it probably quadrupled the size. I mean, the Helmand River would have just been a little sliver of irrigation through the province and would have been just basically flood irrigated by locals and the like. But the USAID project that was built, and it still works, and it still maintains really greatly enhanced the amount of arable land in the province. So and that became important. And so that's kind of that's one of the reasons. And then the population in Helmand, obviously the Lashkargah is the capital. Garesh is also the other major urban area. But we'll talk more about Central Helmand. Central Helmand is the most important to the government of Afghanistan, and that we'll talk a lot about that, because that was absolutely our focus area, right? Lashkargah, Nadali, Garesh, Marja, Nawa, really our focus, because that's the most important piece. That's where most of the population lives. That's where the universities are, the hospitals are, the airports, the roads, and things like that. So that's the most important bit. Next, I think it's important we just kind of a brief piece on the history here and why Helmand is important and kind of what the history of our involvement has been there. And again, I won't go through a lot of it, but you know, Helmand is important because Helmand and Kandahar are really, that's where the Taliban get their start. So just a little bit to the east of Lashkargah, as you move towards Maiwan, and like that was the where the Taliban was founded, and that's that really became their their home, and a lot of the Taliban leadership even today are Helmandis, and so Helmand is a power base for the Taliban. Also, the 9/11 attacks were trained and ordered from Helmand and Kandahar. So this is where the pre 9/11 conditions that gave us 9/11 attacks and the like, it emanates right from here as well. The history of our military involvement there has been significant, and I won't go through the whole thing, but between 2010 and 2014, there was about 30,000 coalition forces in Helmand province, so about 20,000 Marines and about 10,000 Brits as part of the ISAF mission. And, you know, we enjoyed great success in Helmand during those years. And so that's kind of where we said at that point. But as you all know well, the previous strategy was a time-based strategy rather than a conditions-based strategy. So that basically had all coalition forces were removed from the Helmand province in 2014. And that was based on, obviously, the numbers of forces that were going to be allowed to stay in Afghanistan. And then because of the location here, it was unsupportable to keep coalition forces in Helmand. And so that pulled back. And then what happens then is a fairly rapid deterioration of the forces, which then leads to our going back last April. So we showed up there last April, and we really found that our Afghan partners were completely on the defensive and really demoralized. They had kind of suffered defeat after defeat. They didn't feel like they were being supported by the government or anybody else. And then so they were in great difficulty. But what we did have that was important was the Afghan government had inserted some new leadership. So a new corps commander, a new governor, provincial governor, and also a new zone commander. And the zone is like the MOI forces, the Minister of Interior forces that are there. And then coupled with our capability, so we come in with a purpose-built force that was built from the ground up to train, advise, and assist our Afghan partners to help the Afghan government expand population control and also pressurize the Taliban. So what unfolds over the next year is that the Afghan leaders that we worked with, they were unwilling to accept the status quo, which was really, they were really just fortressed up around Lashkargah and Goresh, totally on the defensive, and the Taliban pretty much had the rest of the province, most of the green areas that you see up there. Airports were closed down, the roads were mostly impassable, so the situation was really bad. But the Afghan leaders that we're working with, they weren't willing to accept that, and they wanted to do better. And then once we coupled with our ability to effectively enable them, they really stole the initiative from the Taliban starting in about May of last year. And then once they stole the initiative, they maintained it. And we were able to kind of convince them, and they realized that they were, you know, by holding the initiative and by using tempo as a weapon, they could outpace and outcycle the Taliban. And they were much more successful, and they took far less casualties employing their forces that way, as opposed to letting the Taliban pick the time and place of an attack. So the other thing that's important here is that the Taliban in 2017, I think some of you may have seen it, they came out publicly because they called it Operation Mansouri, and it was essentially their operational plan for last year. In that, they said, we're going to take the rest of the Helmand province, and we're going to take Lashkargah and Goresh, and we're going to make Lashkargah the capital of the caliphate in Afghanistan. So that's their stated goals, and they come out with that very publicly in May. But what we find instead is that they're losing terrain, and they're ineffective. So they're not only achieving their goals, they're losing terrain really critical to that, which was a great blow to them, and we'll talk more about that as well. Okay, I went the wrong way. All right, really four key lessons that we learned during our time there. So I'll talk about these briefly, and we can talk more about them in the question and answer. But Afghan forces, and when we say Afghan forces, we're talking about not just the army, but the police as well. If they're properly enabled, and I put that in bold because that's really critical, properly enabled, can and will defeat the Taliban at the point of attack. We found that over and over again, and they demonstrated that capability, so properly enabled. And we'll talk more about what that looks like. For us, the Afghan center of gravity is their confidence and their willingness to conduct offensive operations. So we viewed their confidence. So at first it was very low, and they didn't think they could win, and they didn't think they were that they had the capability to beat the Taliban. As they started to do it, and as they became more effective, they became increasingly bold and increasingly ambitious, and that had basically a synergistic effect on the problem set for us. So, but we viewed their confidence as the most important thing. So it wasn't necessarily their capability or how much combat power they could bring. It was the confidence that was the most important thing. And then advising activity, the way I view it, it's really a non-kinetic effect. So U.S. advisors or coalition advisors, when they're with a partnered force, they change the dynamic. So it changes the environment, and it, you know, we have to recognize kind of that piece. But then if you talk about advising activity, there's really three big buckets that people will talk about. So advisors can enhance a partner's warfighting capability. You can build the partner's capacity, and you can generate forces. So those are typically the three big buckets of advising activity. And this is not only for the Afghan problem set. This is like any place that we're conducting advising activity. Far and away, we prioritize the ability to enhance the partner's warfighting capability as the most important thing. So that's like their intelligence capability, their maneuver capability, their logistics capability, their command and control capability. Our ability to make that better was the most important advising activity we did. And then last is accompanying Afghan forces on missions can reverse momentum of the campaign and actually create a dependency on U.S. forces. We found our Afghan partners quite willing to go forward and fight for their country, and they didn't need nor want Americans by their side. They were quite willing to do it, if properly enabled, so and if confident, right? So it was kind of a piece we had to kind of step into. So we built their confidence by demonstrating capability. As they became more confident, they became increasingly ambitious. As they became more ambitious, they opened the Taliban up to additional targeting from us and from Afghan forces. So the whole thing kind of comes together. So I would ask you, as you kind of like think through this problem, don't be a reductionist and try to say, well, it's all about the fires or all about the authorities or it's all about the rules of engagement or it's all about the capability. It's not that, it's all of it, right? Is it all kind of comes together. So, okay. And the wrong way again, sorry. Okay. So I talked, and I'll just touch on this briefly. This map represents Central Helmand. So you can see Lashkar Gah up in the center, Nadali, Goresh, the Shorab off to the west. That's where we were located. So this is again, this is the most important bit. So if you ask the Afghan governor, or you ask the corps commander, or you ask the MOI commanders that are there, Central Helmand is our focus because of all the reasons that I talked about before. The dotted line up there kind of represents what's the line of control of the Afghan forces right now. Since we left, our replacements and the Afghan leaders that are still there have actually expanded this a little bit beyond where it is now. But this is kind of where the Afghan government controls. When we got there, the Taliban were very much trying to hold terrain, and they were very much trying to govern, which was different than our previous experience. Since we've left it, they have morphed a little bit because they're realizing that they don't really have the ability to govern and hold terrain against the capability that the Afghan forces now have. So that's kind of that's what that looks like. What's probably important, again, is if you look on the southern part, so from Lashkar Gah to the south, you'll see the Nawa district. Some of you guys are probably familiar with Nawa. It's a very important district, very traditional Afghan tribally, it's very homogeneous tribally, and has traditionally supported the government. And the Taliban held the Nawa district for about a year and a half, I believe. And early in the campaign, we were able to, working with our Afghan partners, to take back the Nawa district. And some of those pictures that are, I know, are probably hard to see, show the Afghans taking down the Taliban flags and raising the Afghan flags on that district. And it's a very large district, and very important. It also was key to facilitating some of the roads and airports and things like that reopening. But really, it became, in kind of marine parlance, it really became kind of a Guadalcanal moment, similar to the way the Guadalcanal was the first victory in the Pacific in World War II. The Nawa district, represented an Afghan success in 2017 in the face of Op Mansouri, when the Taliban had said that we're going to take Lashkar Gah, we're going to take the rest of Helmand Province, and we're going to make Lashkar Gah the capital of the caliphate. But then they're losing the Nawa district right in the face of that. So it was very important, tangibly, and also information. The information effect that it had on the enemy was really, was really critical as well. All right. So this is just kind of as I discussed earlier, like, okay, so buy with and through partnered operations, you hear a lot of talk about that. What does it, you know, what does it look like? And what's under the hood? How do you do it? And so first and foremost, our approach was it was Afghan led. So we never imposed our objectives on any of these missions. It was the Afghans saying, we want to go here, we want to go to Natali, and we want to do it on this date. And then they would kind of all line up on that. And then the advisors and our Afghan partners would all work together to develop a plan that was going to be executable and have the effect that we wanted. And from my perspective, if the Afghans were achieving an objective that they wanted, as long as it achieved my objectives as well, then we completely supported it. So everything worked really well on that. So there would be a couple of weeks usually that would take place to kind of get one of these operations together. And then on game day, it would look something like this, what's on the slide. So on the bottom left there is kind of represents an Afghan maneuver element that we had that would be out there. And this would typically be Afghan army, Afghan police, Afghan intelligence, forces that would be maneuvering. And then our advisors would be plugged in at all as many Afghan command nodes as we could get on. And that's key to, like, the capacity of the force. So and some of that, I know you are aware that some of the forces are increasing there. The more places you can touch and the more command and control nodes that you can put advisors at, then the greater ability you have to sense what your partner's capabilities are and kind of react to. So we would plug our advisors in to that, and then obviously that's plugged into our joint operations center that's on the top. And then out in front there, we would be using a mix of Afghan intelligence gathering capabilities and American intelligence gathering capabilities. But we would blend their intelligence capabilities with ours, and they'd be very much. It wasn't like that. We had the most information, and it was about trying to share it with them. It was a lot of times it was the other way around. They knew far more than we did. We just had to kind of leverage that and use our assets within our capabilities. And then we had a number of fires assets that we would bring to bear. We also had Afghan capabilities, so they have the MD-530 aircraft, they have A-29s. We would integrate them into the fight. We would try to pursue Afghan solutions first, and we saw those increase over time. And then we had a number of American fire support assets, in this case AH-64s, F-16s, B-52s, and alike. And that's where the authorities and that's where the capabilities are important. For us to be able to do it. But with this methodology here, we were able to create an overmatch that the Afghan government forces could beat the Taliban with this system any day of the week. And they did it over and over again. And like I talked about tempo, so I think we were there about 280 days. I think about 250 days they conducted an operation that looked something like this, often in multiple places in the province simultaneously. So we were obviously often very challenged just to try to support our partners, because as they became increasingly confident and increasingly ambitious, their tempo was impressive, and it was difficult for us even to keep up. So that's the, and again, that's under the hood, and we can talk more about this if you have additional questions. But so I think that's really what I wanted to offer as far as opening comments. But I think it's important that the South Asia strategy that was announced last August. This is some of the effects that we're seeing. Our partners now are reassured that our presence is not time-based, it's conditions-based. That has an effect on our partner, and it has an effect on the enemy. And I think we're starting to see the leading edge here, that the Taliban now realize that in the face of an Afghan-enabled force that's effectively enabled, they're not going to be able to achieve the objectives that they have enunciated in the past.
You're listening to Roger Turner, Brigadier General type, United States Marine Corps infantryman, before he was a general officer, now he's a 9900 or whatever they are. He's being interviewed, and he's kind of going through a slide that he prepared in his prepared remarks. by Michael O'Hanlon, the renowned Michael O'Hanlon from the Brookings Institute, who you see all over the place, pretty savvy, smart guy. I cannot emphasize that point enough. The South Asia strategy that was articulated last August. How do we do this so that you can do it? One, I think extremely important is without U.S. casualties, right? Or that number is very, very low. Two, that it can be cost effective. Three, oh, by the way, that it is enabling, right, and not creating dependency on it. So I think what you're seeing is a different view of how, if you reverse engineer from how will the American people support this in a sustained way given our previous 17 years, okay? I think what you're seeing is smart guy way of doing that. Because the frustration is we come in here, we fight with you, but what we did was we created dependence because we did the fighting. And that cannot be the way it works, right? It also is detrimental to us because too many young Americans are dying, and we cannot sustain that. So critical to sustaining it is, A, fewer American casualties, three, enabling them but not creating dependence. And then also in that mix is the smaller footprint, smaller impact fiscally, and that also translates to sustaining it. That sustainment then has an impact on the situation on the ground, and it also has an impact on the Taliban perception of what the future holds. That is the critical piece. Right, and we've talked about, Tim Lynch talked about, stripping little t, which are the Taliban affiliates and people that will fight with them when they're dominant in a region, okay? So stripping the Afghan little t, Taliban, from big T, which lives in Pakistan. If you can split them, if you can show them you're not going to win and bring them to a negotiated settlement for the conflict, then what you've done is you've stabilized Afghanistan. Okay? You've stabilized Afghanistan. And so you can see it's smarter guy fighting, if you will, with a longer term. And so I think that's why I wanted you to hear General Turner and these remarks, because it gives you hope. It gives you hope. But what you're seeing is you saw this first in Iraq, Mosul predominantly. You saw a lot of stuff going on. You didn't see a whole lot of American. At least, I know our special forces guys are in there. In Iraq, we had artillery batteries in there. We had security guys on the ground providing security for them. And you saw a lot, you didn't see a whole lot of conventional American forces going into Raqqa, which we thought would take forever. Well, it didn't take forever. Why is that? What are we doing? What's going on there? So again, General Turner, kind of pulling back the curtain for the rest of us on how do you partner, enable, right, so that you can stay there, so that you can achieve, so that you can win the peace, right, so that you can edge towards winning the peace, and I think that's why this is significant. So he continues right here, right now.
So anyway, I look forward to your questions. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Encouraging to see, and I think we all got a lot out of that. Let me just follow up with a couple of specifics, if I could.
Sure.
I know that General or Secretary Mattis has decided not to share as much information about how many districts are held by the government and how many by the enemy. I have my qualms about holding back that data because it makes it harder for the rest of us to assess the campaign. So can you perhaps at least help us a little bit more quantitatively with Hellman? You mentioned a number of specific places where things had improved. Is there any number in your head about what percent of the populated areas of Hellman is now back in government control? How far are we towards getting to the objective that's desired?
Yeah, I don't have a specific number in mind. I'd almost think it's because, Michael, you get into this thing about, okay, if the government controls the district center, but some areas of the district are still being contested is it in or not? I mean, is it under control or not? So that it gets to be very difficult to define. But I would say this, the effect that we were able to achieve in Central Helmand in particular, now, like if you live in Lashkargah now, you are confident that you can get back and forth to Kandahar without being attacked. If you want to take a flight to Kabul, the airport is open and you can fly back. You know, the city is somewhat peaceful. Obviously, there's still, you know, attacks that do take place. So Lashkargah, Goresh, you know, things are functioning now in the province. This time last year, they were not. The roads were impassable. The airport was closed. So I think, you know, we were able to achieve some good effects. But there's still clearly, you know, work to be done. Our belief is that about 60% of the population of Helmand lives in that central Helmand bit. And I believe it's well within the Afghan capability and capacity to secure that in the face of the current threat. And if the threat goes down, then they'll have even more capability.
So, again, I don't want to push this point too far, but just notionally speaking, because you talked about how bad things were in Helmand before you arrived, at that point, clearly, from what I'm hearing you say, probably less than a quarter of the population lived in a way that was relatively safe from Taliban interference or control. And today, maybe it's closer to 50%. Are those rough numbers wrong?
Yeah, I think that's probably close to the 50% number. But again, it's hard to quantify it, right? Because like if you're in central Goresh right now, things are very good. You know, as you drift out of there into the countryside, there may be a point where, you know, you would be in danger. So it's hard to understand exactly how that would look, right?
And you did all this with, I mean, as you said, the Afghans did most of it. You helped them. But you did all of this with about 300 Marines in province. Is that the right number? And that's going up to maybe 500?
Yeah, so we had 300, and those numbers crept up a little bit during our time there. And then the current force that's there now has more. So what it allows him to do that I couldn't do is he can persist at lower levels, whereas I could go down there episodically for like an operation, and then I had to pull my people back in order to do other tasks. He now has the ability to kind of project it to lower levels, so it's helpful.
So just break that down without asking you to say anything more than you can say in an open forum. Out of several hundred Marines in Helmand, roughly how many different teams and how many different locations? I mean, and if you need to be general, I understand, but or qualitative more than quantitative.
Yeah, so I would say that he's got the ability now, the General Watson, to persist at least two or three additional locations that I couldn't, and then that gives him the capability to make progress faster. So what advising activities, like I said in the brief, it's a non-kinetic activity that allows us, it changes the environment when they're there. So when advisors can plug in and persist at a certain level, you can make progress faster. And so that was where I had to do it episodically. He can do it persistently.
And you were at several locations yourself already.
Yeah.
So he's at two or three more above that. You showed a lot of American air power and also some American artillery.
Yeah.
But you mentioned that the Afghan Air Force is being built with the A-29 aircraft and others. If you had to project, I'm not sure there's a specific goal in mind, but can you give us a feel for over, let's say, the next 2 to 3 years, if we keep on at this mission the way it's being done now, what additional fraction of the air power can be provided by the Afghans themselves?
Yeah, we saw good success with it. So the they were most capable of the MD-530, which is an attack helicopter. And they had those resident inside the Corps, and then they could bring those to bear. And so they had rockets and machine guns, and they were able to support their maneuver forces with that. And then they also used the A-29 to do that. And we were effective kind of working with them to getting them to do what we would consider to be like a frontline Afghan controller that would actually be directing aircraft from a front line, you know, in support of their maneuver, and so that was effect. So I think we saw it grow over time. It's still a difficult task, as you can imagine, as they're trying to grow air crews and maintainers, and then also grow special skills all simultaneously. So I think, you know, the work that the Air Force the work that's being done to increase the Air Force is important work, and we're seeing them to be more and more effective But it is difficult. The degree of specialization and maintainers and things like that, I mean, those are hard. Those are hard. I mean, sometimes those are hard capabilities for us to maintain, right? We're challenged with even in the American military to try to maintain those high skill sets and compete with, you know, private industry and things like that. So they face that as well as they're trying to grow these capabilities from scratch.
Now, you mentioned that it's going to take a while to make this kind of headway, and we need to recognize there's an importance to just saying we're there for the long haul. And one of the dilemmas we've had before is maybe pulling back a little too quickly and being too calendar-based. Other people, though, have also emphasized that part of the problem with working with the Afghan security forces is the amount of turnover and attrition. And so to what extent is your successor and then his successor and so on going to sort of have to keep reinventing the wheel, or to what extent do you think we can actually make durable progress that we can just keep building on incrementally from one command and one year to another?
Right, right. Well, I think it starts with strategy first. So the enduring nature of the strategy is really important. It's really important to our partners that they know that we're going to be with them. And then it's just like I was saying about kind of the aspect of winning. Winning for the Afghans, it has positive impacts in other areas too, right? So when they're winning and they think they're being successful, all of a sudden their attrition rates start to go down. They took like 40% less casualties in 2017 than they took the previous year. So less casualties, higher morale, and then now you don't have as much challenge to get your highly skilled people inside the forces because the problem is not as difficult, right? So it's like winning begets winning, and so we saw a lot of that, but there is still hard work to be done. Force generation, like I mentioned, is a key aspect. We prioritize warfighting function enhancement to give us offensive capability, but the tasks that we do on force generation are really important as well, and so that's an important component of the mission that's being worked on all over Afghanistan as well.
Let me ask two more questions, one about Pakistan and then one recognizing that you don't want to talk about the nationwide picture too much. I just still need to link this discussion to the broader question of the trajectory of the war. But you were bordering Pakistan, and we know that historically a lot of the leaders of the Taliban have been based in Pakistan. That's been part of the problem. We haven't been able to get at them the way we'd like, and they can continue to try to recruit and motivate foot soldiers. I know some of the Taliban leadership in Helmand is probably in Helmand. Some of it may be in Spinboldak or in Quetta Shura over in Pakistan. I wondered if you had, I guess the way to put the question to a point, have you seen any change in Pakistani cooperation or behavior or helpfulness in the months since President Trump has, like his predecessor, like many American commanders and ambassadors, asked the Pakistanis to help us more and stop playing as much of a double game as they historically have been doing?
Hmm. Yeah, the way I would try to answer that is the Taliban and Helmand couldn't exist without external support. And they get that external support from a number of the regional actors. A number of the regional actors have interest there, and certainly have malign influence in the province. And then the second big component of Helmand is the poppy and the opium that's grown there also provides a lot of financing to the Taliban. So really the confluence of external support and the poppy production give the Taliban a pretty consistent source of income that allow them to have men, weapons, and material to be able to kind of continue the fight. So I think the components of our strategy to pressurize the regional players to cease support for the Taliban is a really important component, because I believe that if the Afghans only had to deal with the Taliban, they could deal with it. But the Taliban being enabled by regional actors creates that's probably the reason we need to be involved in supporting them still.
So whatever help Pakistan may be providing, we could still use a lot more. Is that a fair summary? Now, President Ghani has been remarkable in some of his big ideas in recent months. He's a big thinker. We all know that. And one of them has to do with a new peace overture towards the Taliban. And one of them has to do with the military campaign. And I want to ask you about the second, and then we'll bring in others and who may want to bring it, you know, the rest of the topics back to discussion as well. I'll leave the Taliban reconciliation efforts for later and for others to bring up. But I wanted to ask about this goal of President Ghani that ideally within 2 or 3 years, 80% of the country or its population would be back under the control of the government. Current estimates, current unclassified U.S. estimates, of course, are that less than 60% of the government, of the population and territory are controlled by the government, roughly in the high 50s to 60%.
Mm-hmm.
That's down from maybe 70% when General Allen, General Dunford were in command and we had a much larger U.S. military footprint. It was never 80%, I don't think, even in the days of the surge. So how realistic is it and how necessary is it to get to that 80% nationwide goal, recognizing that you only want to speak primarily from your own experience in Helmand, but to what extent do you think that 80% goal is realistic?
Yeah. No, I think the 80% number is important, and I think we should drive towards that. I think that's a good goal that obviously the President Ghani has articulated, and we're supporting him as part of his four-year campaign plan. But I also think it's important that we don't do anything that the Afghans don't have the capability to sustain. And I think some of the lessons from the surge is that, you know, that forces that that pushed the Taliban out of areas that then the Afghans didn't have the capability to sustain, that was very unhelpful for them as we withdrew our forces. So I think what we just need to consider is those are good goals. But kind of consider the confluence between threat and Afghan capability and kind of the interrelationship between those things. So what can they do? What's sustainable? What's supportable? Rather than like letting the number drive us. Because if we just go after 80% of the population, but then they don't have the capability to hold it, then it would be unhelpful, right? So I really think it's kind of that, where is the intersection between threat, if we can buy down the Taliban threat, either through military effects or reconciliation, increase the Afghan capabilities, which is what's part of the campaign, and then set the goal there, right? And I think that's what we just need to be very, very clear-eyed about, that we don't do something that they can't sustain.
Fantastic. Well, thank you. Excellent answers. A lot of information, and I'm sure others want to get into this too. So please wait for a microphone. And then identify yourself, and we'll take a couple of questions at a time, if that's all right. So we'll start up here in the front two rows, the two gentlemen over here on the far side. Take those together, please.
Thanks, General Turner, for doing this. I'm Wes Morgan with Politico. Starting last November or so, we started hearing a lot from Resolute Support and General Nicholson about the new strikes using new authorities on the opium processing facilities, and something that Resolute Support made a big deal out of. You mentioned two things that make me wonder about that. One, kind of not focusing on authorities as the kind of the new thing, and then also not doing things that the Afghans can't sustain. So I was just wondering, based on this deployment and also your previous deployment to Helmand, what's your perspective on the importance of these counter opium processing efforts? I know they're not being described as counter narcotics efforts. And also, what did your partners make of it in the 215th Corps? What did they think was the importance of these new efforts?
Maybe it's easier to let you answer that one directly.
And yeah.
We'll go to Otto next.
Good. Thank you. Thank you for that question. Those are important efforts. So the authorities that we received allowed us to target Taliban financing really what's important is where we could see that there was a clear connection between opium production and Taliban. And so it's actually not hard to do that in Helmand, because most of the Helmand-based Taliban are completely connected to the opium trade, and that's really where they derive a lot of their support from. But anyway, it's an important component. But what was important about it was the combined effect. So Afghan maneuver, like the operations we were supporting with, Afghan maneuver to seize terrain from the Taliban that was being supported, and that was one component. Special operations forces doing targeting as well. So both Afghan independent operations and partnered operation with U.S. special forces was another component. And then you put the you put the counter-narcotic strikes on top of that. So, right, the three of those things together what created a pretty significant effect on the Taliban, and I think that's changed their – our partners were quite keen to do it. They thought it was very important, and we had solid support from President Ghani and also Governor Hayat, who is the governor in the province. And then the Afghans even participated in this to kind of speak to your question about sustainability. The Afghan Air Force participated in these strikes as well.
Marine General Otto Kreischer, Sea Power Magazine. You know, the Army has created this advise and assist brigades that they're sending into Afghanistan and Iraq. What was the force that you had took with you? Were they selectively, were picked selectively? And what kind of training did you get there so that you weren't sending just, you know, conventional grunts into that situation?
Sure.
And your rank level, I assume you had more senior personnel than you normally would in an infantry company.
Right. No, thanks for that. The so we did not have a specialized force. So we had a 300 man force. About half of that force was advisors, and about half of it was not. So the half of it that wasn't is essentially additional capability, and that's quite. Those are conventional outfits that you would be familiar with, like a rifle company and artillery and things like that.
Just to clarify, all your F-16s and so forth, they're coming from either Kandahar or further away, so they're not part of your 300.
That's right. Yeah. But the advising effort. So we drew officers and staff, non-commissioned officers from across. The whole force came out of 2MEF at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. They all came out of there, and they were all, kind of MOS qualified Marines. Some of them had previous advising experience, but a lot didn't. And so, honestly, the Marine Corps is building an advisor group, and we are heading that direction. But we took Marines and sailors who were essentially out of the conventional force and then did some training to bring them up to be able to conduct this. I actually think that in some cases we make way too much of this, that a lot of the capability is, you need to be, like, if you're going to be an intelligence advisor, you need to be a really good intelligence officer or staff NCO. You need to know your trade. You need to know, like, the processes that we use and all that kind of stuff. And then a lot of the interactions that you have with your partners are relatively common sense engagements, right? I mean, the Afghans, we easily strike common cause with our partners and build rapport and things like that. So a lot of the soft skills that I think people, talk about a lot about advising, I think we make way too much of it. And that a lot of this is inherent in the force, and it doesn't require a great deal of specialization. And that Marines and sailors and soldiers that we worked with in Afghanistan, they took to this easily and really performed well and produced some amazing effects.
Language assistance, you have beefed up interpreters.
Yes.
An increased level of interpreters that you do the language.
Sure. Yeah. The most of the interpreters or translators are they're run under a contract. So it's a mix of Afghan local hires and then also some of the higher end are fully, U.S. citizens, fully cleared for, high-level classifications and things like that. So that's mostly a contract piece. And I think, one of the dilemmas, right, if you're going to try to build a force with multiple language capabilities, that's a really difficult thing for us to do, right, because in the Helmand province, even the Afghan army speaks mostly Pashto because that's what the locals speak. And if you go to Kabul, they're speaking mostly Dari and things like that, right? And so to build a language capability inside the conventional force that's going to allow this, that'd be a very difficult thing for us to do.
But by the way, are you seeing more ability to recruit from the Pashtun locals than we were able to achieve 5-8 years ago?
It's consistent on the police side. But they're still challenged on the Afghan army, and so So really, you know, the forces that we employed were mostly Minister of Interior forces that were mostly Helmandis, and then the Afghan army is mostly mostly from around the Kabul cluster, some from Kandahar and the like. But the combined forces that come together was what was powerful. So often the police were very aggressive at the point of attack, knew the area, knew the locals really well, but then they wouldn't go unless the Afghan army was going to go with them to provide them the firepower and the muscle, right? So it was kind of the combined effect where we saw our most success.
Great. See, we go to my friend in the back about the 10th row. A couple rows up. Yep.
Hi, General. Thanks for the presentation. Doug Brooks from the Afghan-American Chamber of Commerce. Two quick questions. One, are the Afghans able to get their goods to Kabul or to the markets on using the roads? Is that all opened up in Helmand province? And second of all, where are the Taliban getting their weapons from? You must have been able to track where they've been produced, how old they are, where's the ammunition coming from? This, we must have some information on this, but I've not seen anything on it.
Thanks for that. The roads are obviously important for people to be able to move, you know, goods and services. So the ring road that goes between Kandahar, between Gureshk, and then towards Points West is fully trafficable, and it's like traffic nonstop on it and things like that. The other highways that would allow you to go from places like Nawa and Lashkargah towards Kandahar, those are now open and are not they're not significantly challenged by the enemy. So the major population centers are connected for goods and services and people to move back and forth and things like that. As you move into the more rural areas and stuff like that, then that's when there's going to be some challenges to those areas. As far as men, weapons, and equipment, or as far as weapons that flow to the Taliban, I think the most I could say would just be is I believe a lot of it comes from the regional actors. So the neighbors of Helmand and Nimruz provide equipment to the Taliban, and some of that they probably provide you know, willingly through, you know, just giving it to them, and then others they probably are buying it using the opium profits to purchase equipment.
Here on the right side, my right side on the fifth row, please.
Hi, General. Caroline Houck with Defense One. You mentioned that once the Afghan partner forces' confidence increased, their desired tempo of operations almost outpaced your ability to provide support. Is that something that's going to be addressed as assets, particularly air assets, are transferred from Iraq, Syria over to the Afghan fight, or is that something more to do with your forces in the area? Thanks.
No, thanks. No, great question. So, I expect that the current campaign, the 2018 campaign, has much more resources than what we had in 2017. So as you know, obviously the fight against ISIS in both Iraq and Syria was still going on during the time that we were doing our operations. So there was times that we didn't have enough. And our Afghan partners, you know, kind of would get close occasionally to outpacing our ability to support them. I don't expect that's going to be a problem in the campaign now. So the campaign is well resourced to really allow all of the tax and task forces to kind of produce some of the capability that I was showing there. And I think that's going to really ratchet the pressure on the Taliban across all of Afghanistan.
Go to the gentleman here in about the seventh row. Tie clip.
Hey, sir. Harrison Lieber, former 7th Marine Regiment. I had a question about the Afghans doing a mission on their own without coalition support, and using that as a basis to judge improvement. Is that something you guys are doing?
Yeah, sure. I mean, and there was plenty of times when they did that, when they did things completely, you know, completely on their own. And like I was saying, we wouldn't superimpose ourselves on it. If they were, I mean, a good example would be medical. So I had the authorities to provide American medical support to Afghans, but we rarely used it. And So even if they suffered like a mass casualty event or something like that, they were pretty proud of their capability to use their Mi-17s to go pick up casualties, fly them back to their hospitals, and then conduct surgery. We would a lot of times send our doctors over there just to kind of see how they were doing and ask them again, like, hey, do you need us? We can bring people over to our camp and we can do surgery and things. And they're like, no, we're good. You know, so they're pretty proud of their capabilities. And so we don't. You know, we don't force ourselves into anything, and so you know, everything that we do, we ask, like, do you want us to help here? And if they do, we do if we can. But they're proud and of their ability to do things themselves. And anytime they could, we let them run for sure.
Quick follow up for me on that, and then we'll go. Oh, go ahead, take your own follow up first.
Do you think any dependencies are forming then, if we just wait long enough, or if we just convey a certain level of weakness? The Marines will bring their F-16s.
Yeah, and that's part of the art of advising, right? I mean, that's kind of the art of this, is that, you know, if you're going to do it for them all the time, then they'll let you, right? And I don't. The Afghans aren't unique in this. I think this is probably in any sort of relationship. We have tremendous capabilities and capacities in our forces and, you know, great weapon systems and things like that. So if you're gonna absolutely do it for them, they'll let you, right? But the art of advising is to kind of increase that and kind of be wary of, okay, if I do this, am I building a dependency, and what is the second and third order effects of that? And so, but again, we kind of looked at confidence as being the center of gravity. The most important thing is their confidence. So we need to do enough to make them successful in this, but not go overboard or whatever. And if they had the capability, like if MD-530s were going to come support a maneuver type of thing, we would just stay out of it and let them do it. And if they achieved the success themselves, then they were even more confident, right? So we wouldn't, and then we would use our assets other places and things like that.
A question on Afghan casualties. One of the concerns in recent years has been the high level of Afghan fatalities in their police and their army, and the estimates have usually not been volunteered in a comprehensive way by ISAF or its successor commands, but they've been estimated in the range of 5,000 to 10,000 killed in action nationwide per year among Afghan forces. I don't want to ask you about nationwide trends, but do you see any improvement in those numbers in Helmand, such that the casualties may be declining over time, one would hope, and thereby make it more possible to keep building up the army and police with less turnover, less loss?
Sure. Yeah, we saw about a 40% reduction in casualties in 2017 in the Afghan National Army that's stationed in Helmand. So the 215th Corps had about a 40% reduction in casualties. But then again, there's a big synergy piece to this too, right? So they also, their AWOL rates dropped significantly. They would send soldiers on leave and then the soldiers would come back, right? So like, you know, a lot of this is just, if a soldier knows that he's not going to be supported and he's likely going to be left to die in Helmand province, if he gets a chance to go on leave, he's not going to come back. And so, as they became successful, now they send that soldier on leave, and he actually comes back from leave and continues on. So it's not just casualties. I think it's the AWOL rates, it's the morale factor. Some of those are, you know, difficult to measure, but we definitely saw that increase.
Excellent. We have time for one or two more questions, so let's go about to the right in front of you. Yes, to the sixth row here, and then we'll come up front.
Sir, good morning. Thank you for your time. Carrie Gray, representing myself today. Leveraging Harrison's question, you talked about how the strategy is improving, their competence is increasing, we're seeing results, and we're often supporting their decisions. Can you talk about a time where there might have been a disagreement, what that looked like, how it was solved, and maybe how it affected the lower-level commanders?
Sure. We weren't successful without having the Afghans kind of all agree on the objective. So it would typically be that the governor, the corps commander, the zone commander, kind of the collective group of generals and the governor all come together saying, this is the objective and this is the most important thing. If that all lined up, we would hit a home run like every time. If there was a difference of opinion amongst the Afghans, then they would be like, well, this is really important for the army, but the police don't really agree. And in some cases, we we still tried to make things work like that, but we very, very rarely succeeded unless there was a confluence of direction from them. So kind of what we consider the Afghan pillars, which really is the Minister of Interior, the Army, and the government, when they're all together in like a triad, then you have a very high chance of achieving success and producing a lot of combat power. If there's disagreement there, then a very low chance of succeeding.
I think we'll take one last question up here, the very front row, and then we'll have to wrap it up, please.
Thank you very much. I'm Marina Fazl, an African-American journalist. I would like to have two questions addressed. There's been, along the years, obviously a lot of talk about where the Taliban are getting military support, weaponry mainly. Recently, there have been more allegations that Russia is becoming much more assertively involved in this. I'd like your comments on that. In fact, Afghan media was reporting one of the Russian representatives having a laugh at this and saying that it's actually from the Afghan military, that all they have to do is to give Afghan military the Taliban money. The Taliban just need money to go and buy the weapons from the Afghan military, suggesting the level of corruption. Hmm. The other question is, what would be your main recommendation to the Trump administration? If you had to condense, you know, send a brief message, while the Afghan population is anxious about its future, with all the ups and downs of these many troops and not many troops, and at the highest of it, as you mentioned, not really quite enough of a commitment to sustain a long-term stability for it to grow and then eventually become something that could be handed over to the Afghans as for them to independently handle. What would be your main recommendation to the Trump administration? What must be done to ensure stability in Afghanistan?
Okay. Oh, thanks. Good, really good questions, and I appreciate those. So as far as the Russian support, I don't know exactly like what exactly they may or may not be involved in. We never had anything that we could directly attribute to them. But what they do I think that's unhelpful is they have a narrative that says, hey, we're the Taliban is important to keep ISIS in check in Afghanistan. And I think the Russians really overblow the ISIS presence in Afghanistan. It's very small and very ineffective. And the Russians kind of talk about that as a reason that the Taliban is important. And that's unhelpful. It's unhelpful for the region. It's unhelpful for the government of Afghanistan. And it's unhelpful for the alliance. The fat part of the problem is still the confluence of the opium production and external support by regional actors. And that's the fat part of the problem in Helmand and the most important thing that we need to address. As far as advice I would give, just based on my time there, would be is that it's going to require a long-term commitment to get the Afghan forces where they need to be. We need to buy down the Taliban's capability, so we need to reduce the Taliban's capability and increase the Afghan capability. And then we need to be committed to the long term. But also we need to do something that's affordable for our country and affordable for the alliance and the other donors. That all needs to be kept in. So I think, like I said earlier, the intersection between threat and capability and affordability, like we need to kind of set that, figure out what that level of investment needs to be in both resources and forces. And then we need to kind of stay with it until we've achieved the level of success.
I want to thank not only everybody on the team of General Turner, but also our own Lieutenant Colonel Gerald Graham and Ian Livingston and others who helped set this up. I don't think I've learned as much in 60 minutes in this auditorium in a long time. There was a lot of information and a lot of hopefulness. So I really want to thank you for coming to Brookings, General.
Great.
Very, very interesting. If you're looking for information for relative to advising in Afghanistan, I think you just got the curtain pulled back on really the link between the tactical level and the strategic level. what we have to do on the ground that enables, that doesn't create dependency, the way we have to be there so we don't suffer casualties but are still affected, the challenge of staying there in a fiscally responsible way so that you can do it for the long term, so the little T can be stripped away from the big T, which then creates the conditions for a negotiated settlement. Okay, so I think General Turner did an awesome job laying that structure and linkage out. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Commandant of the Marine Corps is going to talk about the Marine Corps and our national strategic defense posture. And so on an extended version of All Marine Radio here on a Wednesday, stuff I've had that I wanted to put into the program, and so you get a chance to hear it today. So don't touch that dial, whatever you do. All Marine Radio continues right after this.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.